the flag passes by, my heart breaks. When I hear taps, it's real.
A special honor for Korean veterans on Memorial Day. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, environmental groups oppose a plan to spray weeds along the rail bed.
It's hard for people to oppose it when it's not in their area. So it's kind of a divide and conquer strategy on the railroad's part. Who knows? It might work.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Veterans and their families were joined on the Park Strip in Anchorage today by Senator Mark Begich and Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. The two officials left immediately following the gathering for events at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. They will also travel to Bethel and Quigilingok before returning to Anchorage tomorrow for more discussions with veterans at the Lusac Library. Senator Begich said today's gathering was particularly important because of a special honor and medal given to Korean vets from the Korean government. Begich said what stood out to him was how many there were there to accept the medal.
I was looking at the front row and I saw a few, but then as they were giving the ribbons out, it was row, another row, another row, another row. So it just really shows how many served that are here today. And that really sticks out because that is the first time I've seen that kind of recognition at this kind of ceremony. Usually there are several statements and speeches and so forth, but going out to the audience and how quiet it was, if you notice, no one was saying anything as those ribbons were placed on one after another. So it was very exciting.
Berkeley Ide is the commander of Korean vets in Alaska and has been the master of ceremonies at the Veterans Memorial Day event for the past 10 years. He says the Korean government has a revisit program and for the past decade has invited American veterans of the Korean War to visit the country. While there, they were given the Ambassador for Peace Medal. But Ide says with the 60th anniversary of the Korean War, the Korean government realized there were many vets who would not be able to make a revisit to Korea.
So in order to honor these veterans and give them a thanks from the Korean people, they authorized us to present these medals to these people. So I called all the Korean veterans I had, plus some that we didn't know about. They came in and we awarded today 42 medals. Okay. So, but these are all people who served in the war, been shot at and missed.
Lawrence Killinger is a Korean veteran living in Kenai. He said he'd never been to a gathering of veterans before moving to Alaska. He was overcome as he tried to express his gratitude.
The whole thing to do. It's great. Appreciate it very much.
His wife, Mary Lee, helped express their thanks to the Korean government.
Took the time and the effort to thank the veterans. I don't know of other countries that have done that. Took the initiative and have taken the time and the effort and the money to do this. It was a very wonderful gesture. I appreciate it.
Veteran Morris Breed said his ancestors fought at Bunker Hill. His first day of battle in Korea was July 27th, 1950.
I was with the 29th Infantry. My unit was wiped out. There's only a few of us left. As far as I know, I got a Sioux Indian buddy in South Dakota. Him and I are the only two left of our original outfit.
The magnitude of those words then brought tears.
When the flag passes by, my heart breaks. When I hear taps, it's real.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, the 70th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. A man named David Irons was among the hundreds of cruise ship passengers in Sitka last week, but instead of heading for the national park, downtown stores, or other popular attractions, Irons went straight to the Coast Guard Air Station. 34 years ago, he was in charge of the place as its first ever commanding officer. KCAW's Ed Ronco was there as the first commanding officer and the current commanding officer had a look around.
1953, winter. The Coast Guard cutter Northwind is on patrol in the Bering Sea. David Irons, 22, is a storekeeper, the payroll and requisitions guy, basically, aboard the 269-foot icebreaker.
And we were frozen in the ice someplace north of St. Lawrence Island. And I remember a PBY came out and dropped his mail. And I decided those suckers are going to be home in a nice warm bed in 4 hours. That's for me.
Irons' 31-year career in the Coast Guard moved quickly, beginning with Coast Guard officer candidate training in 1956.
I was assigned to aviation training immediately.
Got my wings, actually, in November of 57.
Chief of Aviation for the Coast Guard.
At that point, I had flown every airplane the Coast Guard had in the inventory.
I retired in 1979.
And somewhere in that montage of assignments was Sitka. Irons was the first commanding officer at Air Station Sitka, serving from October of 1977 until June of 1978. Now, in May of 2011, the 80-year-old retired captain is walking back into the hangar where he comes face-to-face with the Air Station's two Jayhawk helicopters.
I did not have an opportunity to fly this airplane. Beautiful machine.
A huge electrical cable comes out and plugs into the side of one of the helicopters so that Irons can get a look at the cockpit with all of the flat screens and gadgets lit up. It's vastly different from the Sikorsky H-3 helicopters that Irons flew during his career. And when he climbs into the cockpit, it's too noisy to hear what's going on in there. But there's a lot of gesturing and smiling as Lieutenant Josh Tabor explains the controls. I think I hear Tabor explain the autopilot, and then Irons asks, well, if they have autopilot, where do they get their fun? With a smile on his face. And after a good long time, he climbs easily out of the cockpit.
There's absolutely no resemblance between that and the H-3.
But if the technology has changed, the job hasn't. It's still all about rescuing people in distress, and Irons has stories the current crew at Air Station Sitka hasn't heard, including one about a flight that went down off Bjorka Island on October 22, 1962. A Northwest Orient Airlines DC-7, chartered by the military, was en route from McChord Air Force Base in Washington to Elmendorf in Anchorage when, 3 hours after takeoff, the pilot began having trouble with one of the propellers. At the time, Irons was stationed on Annette Island. They rendezvoused, his crew, that is, rendezvoused with the plane in the air and followed it until it ditched in the water near Bjorka. There were 102 people on board.
They all climbed out on the wings and got into life raft, and there was a baby that swallowed seawater in the bottom of one of the rafts, the only injury in the whole thing. And the baby turned out fine.
Commander Doug Cameron now holds the job Irons once did, commanding officer at Air Station Sitka. In the narrow hallway outside Cameron's office are photos of everyone who's held the job.
You can't make the walk to work every morning and not wonder who they are, what they were like, where they are now. Am I standing up to the legacy of those who've gone before me? And of course, the one that always probably would get most people's interest is the person that was first. You know, what was that person like, and what was this unit like in the beginning? And so, when I got a message that he was coming and we'd be interested in having him come to the air station, I was jumping at the chance. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Irons says the feeling is mutual.
I can't even describe the pleasure and how it feels to be able to come back and take a look around at the station we established 30-odd years ago.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The president of the Alaska Senate says tentative plans for a second special legislative session are on hold. Republican Gary Stevens of Kodiak says the House and Senate still can't agree on extending the state's coastal zone management program, which expires July 1st, and they won't meet in special session until a deal is reached. Legislative leaders had told members last week to book airplane tickets for Juneau in anticipation of a second special session. Stevens said Senate majority leaders met yesterday morning to reaffirm their position on the Coastal Zone Management Program. Senators want a provision that allows a governor to dismiss members of a coastal management board for cause only. Senators also want a clear definition of local knowledge versus scientific evidence in coast management. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hundreds attend a memorial for Dr. Walter Sobeloff.
We will dearly miss his wisdom, guidance, and gentle ways.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute Cultural Center planned for downtown Juneau will be named for the Reverend Dr. Walter Sobeloff. Institute President Rosita Wuerl made the announcement Saturday during memorial services for Sobeloff. Fundraising is underway for the Southeast Alaska Native Cultural and Visitors Facility to be built adjacent to Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation headquarters. Sobeloff died May 22nd at his home in Juneau. He was 102 years old and active until his death. More than 500 people from across the state attended services on Saturday to honor the Tlingit elder and Presbyterian minister. Most came for the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp Memorial and stayed the 3 hours through a public commemoration. In the first service, Sobeloff's name was placed in the ANB Book of Remembrance Everlasting, and in the second memorial, he was remembered as a cultural icon and for his great sense of humor. Rosemary Alexander of member station KTOO sent this audio postcard from the gathering.
We are here because Dr. Sobeloff was the one who encouraged us.
Picture, if you will, a beautiful Presbyterian church in Juneau, where Dr. Sobeloff was the preacher. Also in the picture is a full church, a church which Dr. Sobeloff said should be open to all races, a church which was in fact full of people of all races.
In the late 1940s and 50s, he began broadcasting the church services on KJNO. You probably all heard the story when you were growing up. When Dr. Sobeloff's time on the radio was happening, everybody was quiet and everybody was at home because people were listening to it. He made a mistake by saying on the radio, "I envy those of you who are sitting down and eating dry fish." Over the next week, he got a box from almost every town in Southeast Alaska with dry fish. And he always said after that he was very careful not to make his wishes known on the radio.
Dr. Sobeloff was so very dedicated to the A&B, and he was the best role model that we could have ever had.
I call for the second Grand Vice President of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Jeffrey Jackson, to do the roll call of the local camps and A&B and A&S executive members.
Dewey Scan, Willard Jackson. A&B Grand President Emeritus Dr. Walter Sobeloff. A&B Grand President Emeritus Dr. Walter Sobeloff. A&B Grand President Emeritus Dr. Walter Sobeloff.
Mr. Chairman, we call Brother Dr. Walter Sobeloff's name in vain. We can no longer answer. I move that place his name in the A&B Grand Camp Book of Remembrance.
If there is no objections, the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp will place the name of Dr. Walter Sobeloff, Grand Camp President Emeritus, in the Book of Remembrance of the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp Everlasting.
I love the way he was not only a culture bearer, we just heard that as part of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood ceremony. He was a culture bearer, and he also was a culture bridge.
You have seen and heard of his strong moral values and words of wisdom that for over 100 years he gave to us, his people, family, and the state of Alaska. Let me give you an example of his humor. Governor Knowles got elected governor of Alaska. My wife and I, being good Democrats, were invited to come in from Mangoon and come to the inauguration. So we come in, I walk in the door right there, I look up on a stage here, and there's Dr. Sobolev sitting there. Hadn't started yet, so I walked up to Dr. Sobolev. I said, "Hey, Walter, what are you doing here?" He said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you're a Republican. We're inaugurating a Democratic governor. These are all Democrats in this room. You're the only Republican. Does the governor know you're a Republican?" Walter looked at him and said, "Yeah. He told me he looked all over Alaska for a Democrat that could pray and couldn't find one, so he invited me." One time we were sitting in Ketchikan at the ANB convention, and for some reason we started talking about music. And Walter brought up the question of the funeral dirge. I think it was Beethoven that wrote it, I'm not sure. But Walter said, "I've always wondered about that opera, why he wrote it like that and what it means. I think when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask him why he wrote that opera and what it means." And this one smart aleck guy who was sitting by says, "What if he's not in heaven?" And without missing a beat, Walter said, "Then you ask him."
The passing of our beloved Kajakti leaves a large void at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. We will dearly miss his wisdom, guidance, and gentle ways. It is only fitting that the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, SHI Center, be named after this great and honorable and noble man, Dr. Walter Sobolev.
In 2006, after the Alaska Railroad applied for a permit to spray herbicide along the railroad, public outcry ensued. The Department of Environmental Conservation denied the permit. In 2008, the railroad authorized a study on small sections of track and then reapplied to DEC for a permit. Since that time, environmental groups have been following the appeals process on the permit approval. From Talkeetna, KTNA's Sue Dio has more.
A group of organizations and residents are currently wrapped up in the legal process to try and overturn a decision made by Alaska's DEC. An appeal has now been filed in state superior court after a stay of spraying of herbicides was turned down by the Alaska Supreme Court. When the Alaska Railroad applied for a permit in 2006 to spray almost the entire length of track from Seward to Fairbanks, the borough governments along the rail belt and a number of organizations came out in force to oppose the permit. Reasons ranged from pollution of waterways, being afraid of herbicides affecting fish populations, serpent populations not liking the idea that children playing near the tracks might be exposed. The list was almost endless. The DEC denied the permit. The railroad applied again, this time only asking to spray a short section of track south of Anchorage between Indian and Seward. This time was a bit different. Bob Blankenberg, Solid Waste and Pesticide Program Manager with DEC, explains.
The difference between the 2006 application and the one that we approved in 2010 is they used a different herbicide formulation that is approved. It's in fact improved for use in water, where the previous application they had proposed three herbicide formulations that weren't allowed to be put in water.
He adds that the permit changed and the railroad better identified the how, what, and where of their intention.
This time, a combination of the fact that it is approved for use in water and they proposed better means of identifying water bodies and a more robust buffer from the water bodies, along with a real thorough review of everything else involved, made it possible to approve.
The groups that are in the appeal process over the DEC decision to grant the permit are Cook Inlet Keeper, Talkeetna-based Alaska Survival, and Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Becky Long is on the board of directors of Alaska Survival, a group in existence since the late 70s. She does not agree that the permit was complete.
They're supposed to do a vegetation census. They're supposed to identify the vegetation that they want to kill, and they haven't done that. The DEC has just said in its decision documents, just a cursory explanation, well, they're going to kill all unwanted vegetation. And that does not satisfy regulatory requirements. And also, just the fact that they're not even going to post those areas or put a public notice in the media when and where they're going to spray, that goes against the regulatory requirements.
She is wondering if the railroad won't find the piecemeal approach successful.
They want to eventually spray the whole rail track, but they're just doing it piecemeal because it's hard for people to oppose it when it's not in their area. So it's kind of a divide and conquer strategy on the railroad's part. Who knows? You know, it might work.
Alaska Railroad spokesperson Stephanie Wheeler says the railroad stands by their research and their permits. Their objective is still track and passenger safety. Details on studies done at UAF are on the Alaska Railroad website. Long says the groups will continue to follow the legal system and hope the decision will be overturned or that a stay of spraying will be issued. She says she has heard it will probably be sometime this fall when they actually go to court. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Between the high prices of heating fuel and construction materials in the Aleutians, the cost of building a house along the chain and living in it is higher than most places in the United States. But now two groups are teaming up to find an affordable and environmentally friendly design that works for the Aleutian Islands. The Aleutian Housing Authority and the Cascadia Green Building Council have organized a global contest to develop what's called a living building in Atka. Living buildings go beyond most green building standards. Mark Masteller is the Alaska director of the Cascadia Green Building Council, and he explains what buildings must do to qualify as living.
What you're looking at is a net zero energy building, so that means it produces as much energy as it uses over the course of a year. A net zero water building, which means it collects all its own water and treats all its own water. And it doesn't use any toxic materials. So the Living Building Challenge tries to look at all those things that make a comfortable, affordable home and rolls those all in together into one standard.
That means that the building's environmental footprint would be minimal and that the space would be practically self-sustaining. Masteller says that the building should also promote local food production. The building that AHA and Cascadia want designed is a single-family home that would replace one of the houses in the village of Atka. If this housing project is deemed a success, AHA's goal is to see homes like it sprout up across the Aleutians. Masteller says that it's important for design entrants to factor things like wind, cloud cover, and fluctuations in sunlight over the year as they're coming up with ways to heat and power the house. The building should also match the lifestyles of the community's residents.
We use the metaphor of a flower because a flower is rooted in place, and yet it gets all its energy from its environment. It doesn't pollute the environment. It, you know, uses and collects and treats its own water. So the idea is that the footprint matches the ecological systems and cultural and social systems that are part of where that building is placed.
The best design will be announced next May. The winners of the competition will be awarded $35,000 and given the chance to see their design completed. What makes a neighborhood a good place to live? Last week, delegates from four countries gathered in Anchorage to answer those questions. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The 36th National Neighborhood USA Conference began Wednesday. Besides 28 states, there were delegates from Canada, Japan, and the Philippines. The Anchorage Federation of Community Councils hosted the event that focuses on ways to improve neighborhoods. Improvement takes many forms and is represented by dozens of different workshops. Former president and senior NUSA member Elton Gatewood lists some of the beginner level sessions.
A basic workshop would be how to organize a community. One may be grant writing. One may be how to beautify your neighborhood. One may be how to interact with your elected officials. And so anything that you can imagine, we will address, because a neighborhood is a comprehensive kind of thing.
Gatewood says no matter where the neighborhood may be, the residents normally have the same desires.
It transcends boundaries, okay? It even transcends oceans. That people love to have a good quality of life. They want safety in their community. They want beautification kinds of projects. They want economic development. They want social change.
Current Neighborhood USA President Tige Watts notes while the neighborhood desires may be pretty consistent, the situations they find themselves in can be pretty fluid.
The challenges today will change on you in a heartbeat, so staying current with those are very important.
Watts says that sharing is what makes these annual national gatherings so valuable. George Lee Jr., president of the Spring Lake Neighborhood Association in Birmingham, Alabama, says he's seen something in Anchorage he wants to take back to his community.
Because we have so many abandoned houses and vacant properties that sit because of title situations and stuff of that nature, it allowed us to see other ways, that alternative ways that we could use to better our neighborhoods, get away to blight property, as well as reinvest in that community.
Watts says another of the organization's goals is to find ways to foster a neighborhood feeling.
The other thing we really try to do is we try to help neighborhoods think about ways that they can get away from the backyard cultures and more back to their front porch societies. And, you know, promoting more neighbor-to-neighbor interaction, promoting more neighborhood organization that encourages more events.
Lee says that's what he observed during the Mountain View tour.
They was really involved in the neighborhoods, bringing about revitalization in the neighborhoods. They showed us the Cook Inlet homes that they was doing out in that area, and it was really nice. Showed us some of the log cabins, some of the history still in that neighborhood. And they showed us a beautiful, beautiful sculpture. And there was many faces, all nationalities, superimposed on steel, right on the corner. I thought that was fabulous. One of the neighbors whose face was on the sculpture was there talking about her experiences in Mountain View, and it was really, really moving.
This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.